What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's been 408 days since October 7th, and Israel's genocide in Palestine has claimed upwards of 44,000 lives, according to the Palestinian Health Authority, a number we know is an undercount. Law and Disorder has spent most of our Mondays since October 7th engaging in Palestine Post with a full hour of coverage focused on Gaza and the moving genocide. We continue that coverage today. Our first guest is Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer, was recently republished in its seventh edition. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good to be with you, Kat.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to start, Phyllis, with your analysis of the impact of a Trump presidency on Gaza and the genocide. During his campaign, Trump said several times he would end what he calls the war in the Middle East. We call it a genocide. What do you think he means? What does an end look like under a Trump presidency? End in air quotes.
Well, I think it doesn't look good because his view, I think, of what ending the war would look like is to give Israel everything it wants. So it could, quote, end the war with whatever the consequences are for Palestinian lives, Palestinian rights to their land, any of that. And it means opening up even more weapons faster, in greater numbers, without any even hint of restrictions. There's virtually no restrictions now, but that could get worse. And then claim that he did it so that they could end the war sooner. I think that's really what we are looking at. And I think if we look at his proposed officers, his proposed cabinet members, his proposed ambassadors, we see what his position is. I think it's important to recognize that on the main aspects of U.S. policy towards Israel, which is characterized first and foremost by massive economic, political, diplomatic, and military support, I don't think we will see a major change. The support for the genocide will remain, and I think there will be even stronger opposition, if that's possible, in the United Nations. An equal or greater disdain for the international isolation that is facing the U.S. right now, specifically because of its support for the Israeli genocide. So I think in those ways, the difference will not be enormous. We should note that the symbolically enormous policy shifts that Trump undertook in 2018 during his first tour in the White House, which were essentially a gift to the most extremist elements of the Israeli right wing, things like recognizing a unified Jerusalem as the capital only of Israel, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, the acknowledgement of Israel's claim that the Syrian Golan Heights is now under Israeli sovereignty, closing the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, which was used largely by Palestinians, all of those things. When President Biden was campaigning in 2020 for that election, he came out quite strongly against those positions and said, I don't support this. This is not my position. This is outrageous. But when he was elected and came into office, he did not reverse any of those positions other than a kind of ambiguous statement from his Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, who said some version of settlements are still a problem. But he didn't completely reverse what Trump had said, which is settlements are legal. So essentially, these are Biden's policies, these extremist policies that President Biden said he did not support. And I think it's probably true that he doesn't support them. But what he thinks or wants is really irrelevant if he allows them to remain. So in all those ways, I think we will not be seeing a major change. Where we will see a major change is the relationships with Israel, with the United Nations, and elsewhere, if we look at who these people are that Trump is planning to appoint. So if we start with Michael Huckabee, his choice for the new U.S. ambassador to Israel. The Israeli right wing is jubilant at that choice. He has called for annexation of the West Bank for years, not just since Trump called for it in 2018, but for a decade or more. He has said over and over again, there is no such thing as a Palestinian. There is no such thing as the, quote, West Bank. There is only Judea and Samaria. There is no such thing as occupation. This is Israeli land. He has said there's no such thing as settlements. These are cities and communities, he says. And there's actually an interesting quote about him from Luis Moreno, who is the former deputy ambassador to Israel a few years ago. And he posted, and I have the quote here, he says, I unfortunately was exposed to Huckabee during his visits to Israel back in the day, full-blown and knowledgeable fanatic of the end of times, apocalypse, Israel's destruction, etc. A true and utter nutcase. Couldn't be a more dangerous selection. And of course, what Moreno is referring to here is Huckabee's beliefs. He is a strong holder of Christian Zionism, which is a thoroughly anti-Semitic theological position that basically links the second coming of Christ, something very important, obviously, to many evangelical Christians, to not just the protection of Israel as a state as it exists today, but protection and support for the whole Zionist project of the, quote, ingathering, as they put it, the ingathering of Jews in the land of what was Palestine and is now Israel. And what the theology says, the reason that it's anti-Semitic, is that it says that the ingathering of all the Jews in Israel is the requirement before the second coming. And when that happens, when the Jews have all been ingathered and the second coming happens, the Jews will have a choice to either convert or die. I gotta say, as a Jew, it's not exactly my favorite choice, you know? So there is this thoroughly anti-Semitic core to that theological belief. And this is who is now going to be representing the United States to Israel. He is a gift to the Israeli far right. Similarly, at the United Nations, Trump says he wants to appoint Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman who led the charge against the at the congressional hearing of presidents of major universities, Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, MIT, that led several of them into forced resignations, took the position that any criticism of Israel is ipso facto anti-Semitic. And ironically, she is a complete opponent of the United Nations. She supports settlements, anti-Palestinian, all those things are true. But in the context of her becoming the ambassador to the United Nations, she's one of the most anti-UN forces in Congress. And that's going to be an interesting period at the UN if she indeed is confirmed by the Senate, or if what will become President Trump appoints her on a temporary basis without needing to go to the Senate for confirmation on the grounds that he will do it during a period when the Senate is not in session. It's a trick that they will sometimes use. So both of those appointments give a good sense, I think, of where Trump stands on how he sees going forward in his Israel-Palestine policy. There's some differences around the going back to his Abraham Accords. I think they will move forward more radically than they did under Biden. But that's really...
Phyllis, can you tell my listeners what the Abraham Accords are?
Sure,
I was
sorry.
Going to go there. Yeah, thanks.
The Abraham Accords are a set of agreements between Israel and a number of Arab states. Right now, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Sudan, Morocco have all signed various versions of normalization ties. And this was part of a process that Trump put into motion, which Biden then carried out, although he wasn't able to accomplish much with it, not for lack of trying, particularly trying to get the Saudis in there. The goal is to bring to consolidate, shall we say, a regional mobilization against Iran that would be led jointly by Israel and the Gulf Arabs, the wealthy Gulf monarchies, repressive dictatorships, all of them, along with smaller countries, less powerful countries like Morocco or or Sudan that Israel can essentially buy off. In Morocco, for instance, the buy-off was, sorry, that the United States, not Israel, that the United States can buy off in order to get them to sign these normalization accords with Israel. So in the case of Morocco, the U.S. agreed to recognize Morocco's illegal occupation of Western Sahara. That has been a longstanding conflict in the region. Almost no other countries support that or acknowledge that as a legitimate occupation. But the U.S. says, now we do. We are about the only major country recognizing that occupation as somehow legal. And that was the price that the U.S. gave to Morocco to get the king to sign on to this normalization process with Israel. In the context of the genocide underway in Gaza, it has become even more difficult than it was earlier for these governments to sign anything resembling a normalization agreement with Israel. Not because they don't want to. These governments would all love to have completely normal relations with Israel. Economic trade, political relations, tourism, whatever, and access to the Israel market, all of those things. But their populations are massively against that. These are generally governments that really don't care what their population thinks. Absolute monarchies, military governments, etc. They're far from democracies, let's say. They're not that interested in what their populations have to say, but they are interested if their populations become agitated and mobilized enough to actually threaten their stability, as we saw during the Arab Spring. That's what they're concerned about. So right now, I don't think that's going to go much further at the moment, as long as the Israeli genocide in Gaza and its massive escalation against Lebanon continues. So that's really the set of things that we're looking at here. The one other thing I should just note is that the new Israeli ambassador to the United States, I would guess somebody who was appointed to make Trump happy, if you will, is a guy named Yektiel Leitir, who actually was born and raised in the United States. He's a US citizen, a dual national with both US and Israeli citizenship. And when he was young, he was a member of the U.S. organization known as the Jewish Defense League, a terrorist organization of Jewish extremists that was led by the late Rabbi Meir Kahane. I should note that one of their spinoffs, a group called the Jewish Defense Organization, that broke with them some years into their extremism, shot into my house in Los Angeles many years ago. So I have a
wow.
But in this context, I think that his appointment was designed to signal to Trump that we're going to put forward people like you, extremists, the right wing, people who are outside the norm, something like that. So I think that's what we're going to be looking at in this next period.
Sure, Phyllis. Thank you for that. We've got just a couple more minutes, and I do want to touch on a couple of things. One is, you know, over the weekend, we saw 111 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip murdered on Saturday. Yesterday, 76 more. The offensive in the north continues. Biden told Israel, if you didn't let aid in by November 13th, we're not sending you any more weapons. Well, it's November 19th, and we haven't seen any decreased support. So I just wanted you to touch on that briefly, please.
Yeah, the pressure on the Biden administration was escalating. And it was in response to that pressure that Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense wrote a joint letter to their counterparts in Israel a month ago on October 12th, saying that there was a big problem, particularly in the north, that the humanitarian conditions were getting worse and worse, and that Israel really needed to do more to allow in a massive surge of humanitarian supplies to prevent famine and prevent widespread death. It didn't even address the bombing. It was really about the question of humanitarian aid, of hunger, starvation, lack of water, et cetera. And it said that they had to take into account that U.S. law, not international law, but U.S. law, specifically referencing, although I don't think they mentioned it in the letter, but their reference was to the Foreign Assistance Act, which says very specifically that any country that does not allow in U.S.-supplied humanitarian assistance cannot receive U.S. military assistance. Period, full stop. It's an absolute. They did not in the letter say it was a specific deadline, that if you don't do this, we will do that. It said you must think about that. It was sort of, if you don't do it, we would consider the possibility that maybe sometime in the future, if things didn't change again, we would consider, you know, it was qualified, 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 but it did hint at a deadline. And to their credit, many in the press and certainly social movements supporting Palestinian rights massively took up the challenge to say, all right, this is a deadline. Israel has to do this by November 12th. Well, November 12th last week came and went, and 8 very widely respected international aid organizations, including Save the Children, Médecins Sans Frontières, I can't remember all of them, they wrote a specific letter saying that Israel not only failed to meet the U.S. criteria, but also had taken actions that, quote, dramatically worsened the situation on the ground, particularly in northern Gaza, and that that situation is in an even more dire state today than a month ago. The State Department's position was, well, they've done some good things. We think they should do more, but they've done some good things. And we have, quote, had not assessed that Israel is in violation of U.S. law. That was the end of that. And the weapons continued to flow. So that's what we're dealing with.
All right, Phyllis, I've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll talk to you soon.
Looking forward to it, Kat. Thanks.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fortnox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.